What in God's name do you need a solvent for except to kill someone?
That's an outrageous slur.
Google it, mate.
The only way that you can preserve peace is to prepare for war.
Views on News with Mark Latham. Mark Latham.
The leader of One Nation in New South Wales, Mark Latham, joins me on a Friday afternoon. Hello, Mark. How are you?
Good, thanks, Brent. Very good to be with you.
Thank you for swapping days. We appreciate it. Well, the big story yesterday, Mark, veterans have condemned today, what do they say, the baying for blood of Ben Robert Smith that followed yesterday's defamation judgment. Justice Basanko's federal court judgment found allegations that Robert Smith was a war criminal who murdered innocent Afghan civilians and disgraced his country were substantially true. Afghan Special Forces veteran Heston Russell said today that those calling for Ben Robert Smith to be stripped of his Victoria Cross were misinformed. He said this is a war crimes case. This is not a war crimes case. It's not being tested on a criminal standard.
Well, I think that's right. Defamation is a civil matter where Robert Smith decided to take on the Channel 9 newspapers that had run these exposés about him. They had some information from former colleagues of his in the SAS and other material that they decided to publish. Ben Robert Smith, Australia's highly decorated war veteran, decided to take them on to clear his name and seek damages. And in the decision announced yesterday, he missed out altogether. But that's not at a criminal level of proof. It's not a war crimes tribunal. It's not a criminal court under any jurisdiction. So it's got a bit messy now, but unfortunately for Ben Robert Smith, those who've been pursuing him over a long period of time will now describe him as a war criminal, a murderer. These sorts of headlines were around, you know, within an hour of the judgment yesterday. So what he does, I suppose, will come down to further defence of himself, and we'll have to wait and see if any of the Australian Defence Force authorities or the police or anyone else decides to take action in a criminal jurisdiction. That's very uncertain at the moment. I suppose overall, my view is, you know, Ben Robert Smith must be regretting the fact that he didn't let sleeping dogs lie, that he decided to run the court case against the Channel 9 newspapers. You know, most of us can't even remember the contents of the program and the newspaper articles. These things pass over time, but at enormous expense over more than 100 days in court, he ran the defamation case. But for me, the bottom line is we sent these young men overseas as part of the SAS to do, you know, military jobs that we wouldn't do ourselves. The SAS arrangements, of course, are always shrouded in secrecy. It's a theatre of war. It's kill or be killed. You know, it's as wretched and fierce an environment as you could send any young man. We did that as a country in Afghanistan. Who are we to pass judgment on how they handled themselves and how they survived? That is my sort of standard on the matter, but it's also sad to see that the normal unity of the SAS broke down to the point where some of his colleagues were lagging him in, and that's been the source of his problem.
There's been calls by other politicians already for his medals and uniform that are on display at the Australian War Memorial to be taken away immediately. Your thoughts on that?
Well, again, I think that's overreach. I think that's a bridge too far. He was awarded the Victoria Cross for sound reasons. This was a civil case judgment yesterday. It's not any proof of criminal wrongdoing. So that's yet to be determined, if at all. So politicians can react to a defamation judgment. I suppose they like to be seen favourably by the Channel 9 newspapers themselves. But I think it's better for people to move on. And if there's any material in the case that a war crimes tribunal or the police need to look at, it's a matter for them and them alone.
Wednesday, Philip Lowe. I mean, I've been banging on here for ages about Philip Lowe, the governor of the RBA, being completely out of touch. But my goodness me, with what he said on Wednesday, telling us basically to, you know, take another roommate in, and that's going to solve the problem of our housing situation here in Australia and our rental crisis, and he thinks that rents should be put up and that housing prices should go up. In fact, I've got a little bit of audio here, Mark, that I'll play you for. This is exactly what he said.
The underlying issue here is supply and demand in the rental market. The vacancy rates in many cities are very low. There are a few things that have contributed to that.
Mm-hmm.
During the pandemic, the average number of people living in each household declined. People wanted more space, they were working from home, rents actually declined for a while, and people said, well, rather than have a flatmate, I'll just have an office at home. And so the average number of people living in each dwelling declined, and that increased the demand as a result for total number of dwellings. We need more people, on average, to live in each dwelling.
I wonder if he's going to take, he and his wife will take a couple of housemates in their $5 million home in Sydney. Honestly, Philip Lowe doesn't get it. Young people are living at home for longer than any other generation. Working people are sharing houses into their 30s and 40s, or share housing into their 30s and 40s. And many people on low incomes are just stuck in overcrowded homes, Mark.
Yeah, it was a moment where Philip Lowe was really telling young people how to suck eggs. Self-evidently, young people would know, with the cost of living crisis and the housing affordability crisis, increases in rents, that sharing accommodation is the only way in which they can cope. So the young generation have worked this out already, and it was quite gratuitous to hear that from the governor of the Reserve Bank. But, Brent, I think the overall problem, and Philip Lowe didn't mention it at all, is the lack of housing supply. In New South Wales, it's almost like the Department of Planning has been on strike. They haven't approved the new housing lots for detached housing, and we haven't got moving with improved densities, particularly on Sydney's North Shore, where the councils there, under the former Liberal government, basically just ignored all their housing targets and did nothing to provide extra accommodation. So the easiest way to bring down rental and home ownership prices is to increase supply, and in New South Wales it's been a disaster, to the point where if you talk to the major apartment builders, investors in New South Wales, or they used to be in New South Wales, they say, well, I don't invest here anymore, I put all my money in Queensland, where a Labor government in Queensland gives fast-track approvals, they're opening up new development opportunities, and are seen as miles ahead of the former Berejiklian and Perrottet governments in New South Wales. So I think that's the guts of the problem. It's not bringing in Roger the Lodger, it's doing something about housing supply.
Yeah. Late last year, a bill was passed to give first home buyers an option to pay an annual land tax instead of stamp duty on properties of up to $1.5 million. Now, since its inception, almost 5,000 properties have become part of the land tax scheme. The government now says that the option will cease to exist from the 1st of July, but homeowners who have already opted in can continue to pay the land tax until they sell their property. Labor made it clear they would abandon the land tax choice in the lead up to the March election, and that's exactly what they've done.
Yeah, we went through the parliament late last night. Chance to have a choice between a lower amount of land tax over a longer period of time or to pay your upfront stamp duty has now ended, or will from the 1st of July. So what was wrong with the choice? 5,000 homeowners thought it was in their interest to avoid the upfront stamp duty. That's a good thing. They made a judgment in their own financial circumstances of what was going to work best for them. So I don't know why the new Minns Labor government thinks they know more about the circumstances of those would-be homeowners than the people do themselves. So a choice generally is a good thing. Avoiding a big upfront tax that averages $50,000 in Sydney, that's a very good thing. But now it's ended. So I voted against it yesterday, and my view always was that the scheme should be extended beyond 5,000. If there's 50,000 people who can get into home ownership by avoiding stamp duty up front, well, that's fantastic. And there was a report out of Canberra with the Productivity Commission that because of upfront stamp duty being so onerous, about a quarter to a third of all people in New South Wales are living in places they'd rather not be. They'd rather live closer to their place of work or where their kids go to school, but the stamp duty stops them from buying a new house. So, you know, that's a big problem in terms of productivity and urban efficiency, and we've gone backwards on that front as well.
Yeah, we have, absolutely. The Education Minister says it's okay to teach the voice in New South Wales schools.
Yeah, you won't see this in the newspapers, but it's come from the Education Minister, Prue Carr, in answer to one of my questions on the notice paper, we just got this yesterday, where her argument is, I asked, should schools be involved in partisan political issues? Has a directive been issued to government schools for teachers to avoid teaching and advocating in favour of the Voice referendum, which has become so controversial? And she says that the study of current affairs and matters of public interest, such as the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Voice proposal, is consistent with the New South Wales curriculum. So she's given them the green light. I would have thought a better answer is to say we've got a large number of students, even in our high schools, who can't read and write. Let's stick on the basics and keep politics out of the classroom. And anyway, we're talking about students who can't even vote. They can't even vote on this particular proposition about the Voice. And already we've seen material coming out of the schools where the students are subject to propaganda advocating for the Voice. They haven't got a vote, but they're sort of being indoctrinated with this level of politics, whereas we know for a fact that the basics are being ignored in our schools. And just take one cohort, but every year 17,000 students go into high school, year seven, who can't read and write to a decent standard. So it seems remarkable that Prue Carr has given a green light for Voice propaganda in our schools instead of just sticking to the basics.
Anything they can do to get it over the line. I see that young Australians, according to, who was it? He was at the press, the National Press Club this week, the Don Farrell. He has said that young Australians are expected to be the key to the Indigenous Voice referendum succeeding. We've been saying this, I think, since one of the first surveys came out months ago now, and it seems that the under 55s will vote for the Voice. The over 55s tend to oppose the Voice. And there's more, the simple equation, Mark, is there's more under 55s than there is over 55s.
Well, that's probably right. I'm not disputing what the surveys say, but the mathematics of a referendum means you need to pass two tests. One is to get a majority of yes votes Australia-wide and also a majority of states. So you need to get four out of the six states to vote yes. And I suppose there's an assumption that New South Wales and Victoria will vote yes, but the outlying states, Tasmania, South Australia, WA and Queensland, if any three of those vote no, then you won't get the four states voting yes. So, you know, that's where the action is. The referendum results in Australia are always determined not so much on demographics and age group, but rather on geography. And I think you'll find as the date of the referendum comes closer, once it's announced, the campaigns will heat up in Queensland, WA, South Australia and Tasmania in particular. That's really going to determine whether it's the referendum's approved or it's knocked back.
The date, we're told, everyone thinks it might be October, but who knows? I mean, it just seems ridiculous that at this point in time we don't have a definite date yet as to when we will be going to the polls for the referendum.
Well, there's plenty of noise and bluster about it, isn't there?
Yeah.
I mean, everywhere you turn, particularly on social media, it's all about the Voice. Albanese makes speeches about it, Linda Burney. Both sides are out there campaigning without a date. So it does seem strange. Why can't Albanese give people a date and let them know, you know, when it's going to be sorted out? So I've never seen a referendum where the wording's been announced and there's so much campaigning, yes and no, but no actual date, where Australians can think, well, okay, let's sort it out. And after that date, one way or another, we won't hear about the thing again.
And, of course, this week, I think it was Monday night, was it Monday or Tuesday night, at his speech in Adelaide, the Prime Minister was basically saying anyone that doesn't agree with the Voice, we're all chicken littles.
Well, I don't know what that means, but the basic problem he's got is he's trying to say it's an advisory committee with not a lot of power. Well, if that's the case, why do we need to change the constitution? There's already 85 government-funded Indigenous advisory committees around Australia, so I don't know why an 86th is going to make that much difference. But if you are changing the constitution, there's no doubt these matters will be sorted out with appeals and judgments in the High Court. The power of the parliament will be weakened because you've put a new head of power in the constitution. So Albanese can call other people chicken little, but he's sort of chicken confused, in that it's hard to know what he really wants out of this proposal. It's something that came out of a group of Indigenous at Uluru with their statement, and he's adopted it and made it an article of faith. But as long as there's confusion as to what it really means, I think it maximises the no vote. Because if you don't understand it, why would you vote for it?
Let's talk about Joe Biden. Joe Biden fell over overnight. he did. The poor bloke, he reckons he fell over a sandbag.
Well, he face-planted. It's a pretty bad look, and it follows a whole series of incidents that, he stumbles down the stairs, coming off the plane, falls over left, right and centre. I mean, he's 80 years old now, and there's always this debate, has he got the mental capacity to be the President of the United States? I suppose in terms of the visuals, there's nothing worse than falling over the way he did yesterday in the United States. So doesn't it just further undermine confidence in this, the ability of this guy to do the job? And, you know, we're all worried about the rise of China, but we should also be worried about the decline of the United States, that their leadership is just so old, so controversial. You know, you wish they could find a new, young, competent person to, you know, restore their leadership of what we used to call the free world.
Yeah, it really is sad, isn't it, when you see things like that time and time again.
He looks positively dottery. Yeah, I mean, he does look like, the way he speaks and falling over, you know, it's hard to believe that, you know, if you showed someone who didn't know anything about politics, oh, what do you think this guy does? Is, maybe he's involved in running, you know, a local council out the back of nowhere. And if you said, oh, he's the President of the United States, they wouldn't believe you.
No, they wouldn't. Well, Wednesday night, time and time again, State of Origin, in their 43-year history, the Queensland have found a way to win. The unwinnable, and on Wednesday night, they did the same at Adelaide Oval. There was a crowd of, nearly 49,000 people there. And the Maroons did it again, 26-18. They took match one, victory over New South Wales, and they've got their hand firmly planted on that Origin Shield already.
Yeah, they do. The next game's at Suncorp, where they rarely lose in their own backyard. So, you know, we're heartbroken again as New South Wales fans, but Brent, doesn't it happen just too many times to be a coincidence where Queensland have their backs to the wall? They lost Flegler to the sin bin, I thought pretty unfairly, with a tackle that wasn't all that exceptional, but he was off for the last 10 minutes of the game. They lost both their wingers, so they had Ben Hunt and one of the second rowers out wide, so their positional play and structure was a complete debacle. They were one man down, and yet they put on 10 points and won the game. So Queensland have this uncanny ability to score the last couple of tries in these games and pull off victories that no one could possibly imagine. So I can only assume there's something in the culture of these two teams that makes a huge difference and gives Queensland an amazing advantage. They're doing something in their ethos, their spirit, their preparation that New South Wales just can't match at the back end of the games. And I'd love to see a documentary of someone who went into the Queensland camp and listened to the talk and the ethos and the way they approach it, went into the New South Wales camp and identified this difference, because culturally, as a sporting team, they just seem to be way ahead of New South Wales. And even though we go into these games year after year saying, oh, we've got the best team, we end up with a losing result.
Too many times, unfortunately. We'll keep our fingers crossed for game two. I got to love you and leave you. Thank you for swapping to Friday. You have a great weekend, and we'll be back to our usual time next Thursday.
Look forward to it. All the best.
Thank you, Mark. Bye-bye. Mark Latham, leader of One Nation in New South Wales.